Tentor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents What the Greeks Did for Us by Tony Sporforth. Narrated by Michael Langan. Prologue. What did the Greeks do for us? I hate the ancient Greeks. No, I don't hate them. That's too strong. But what have they got to do with me? Athens and Sparta may not be uppermost in the minds of most people going about daily life in the 21st century. That said, there are many around the world who may be challenging the ancient Greeks more or less unawares, using words derived from the ancient Greek language, watching modern Olympic sports, playing a video game set in ancient Greece with a name like Assassin's Creed Odyssey, and so on. This book seeks to track down the ways in which something as old and seemingly outdated as ancient Greece does, indeed, still have something to do with us. For this book, the emphasis on the present day is key. Already in their ancient heyday, the Greeks had created a civilization that made a big impression on neighbors. The pièce de résistance of a small museum in eastern France is a fancy bronze bowl over 5 feet high. Archaeologists found it in a burial mound of a high-status Celtic woman who had died around 500 BC. This breathtaking vessel, with its appliqué bronze figures of Greek soldiers and chariots, was made in a smithy in ancient Greece. It had travelled perhaps up to 1,500 miles before finally becoming the deceased's prized possession. In the 100s BC, the ancient Romans conquered the ancient Greeks. In the process, they too fell under the spell of Greek culture, older and far more advanced and sophisticated than their own. Over the centuries that the vast Roman Empire endured, its peoples mixed up the two cultures, Roman and Greek. They became, in some ways, almost inseparable. From the AD 400s on, a weakened Roman state morphed into a patchwork of regional powers. Of these, at first, by far the greatest was based on the city of Constantinople, today's Istanbul. In the AD 600s, the lands ruled by these Eastern Romans were threatened by an increasingly mighty Islamic caliphate. This was a new empire, larger even than Rome's in its 2nd century AD heyday. Although the ancient Greeks themselves had by then more or less faded into legend, splinters of their civilization stayed embedded in this post-Roman landscape. This was true not least of Constantinople. Here, medieval Roman emperors ruled over subjects whose first language was a direct descendant of ancient Greek. As the Middle Ages closed, Christendom in Western Europe experienced the lightbulb moment in world history known as the Italian Renaissance, or Rebirth. It is an extraordinary fact that this momentous cultural movement, seen by many historians as progressive, leading indeed to modern thinking, had, as one key trigger, a reawakening of interest among men, and some women, in the long-dead civilizations of ancient Greece and Rome. For the next 400 years, the perfume of ancient Greece infused the cultural air of both Europe and its Western outliers to an extent hard to grasp today. A walk in a park in central Sydney, Australia, takes you past an elegant cylinder of masonry carved in the ancient Greek style. This is a replica of the Lysicrates Monument, a relic of antiquity in the heart of modern Athens. The Australian copy was made in 1868 for a rich and prominent immigrant who was all too conscious of his humble origins. In many ways, the 1800s saw the climax of the Western love affair with ancient Greece. Victorian Britain saw the appearance of the Greek play bishop, the type of Anglican clergyman who was supposedly given a bishopric because he knew ancient Greek so well that he could edit the text of an ancient Athenian play in the original language. It would be easy, as other books do, to wander with a listener through the byways of this and all the earlier centuries in which men and women of the past have drawn knowledge and inspiration from ancient Greece. Chapter 1 offers its own overview of this story. The efforts of these earlier enthusiasts for ancient Greece helped form the links in the chain of transmission connecting the ancient Greeks with today. However, the rarefied world of scholars and classicists, people who study the ancient Greek and Roman worlds, especially through their languages, is not the chief concern of this book. To repeat, here we go in search of the ways in which ancient Greece is present in our culture and society now, in the words we speak and write, in how we entertain ourselves, how we do politics, medicine, religion, and sport, how we identify ourselves sexually and seek self-fulfillment, and how we imagine ideals of beauty. What this book uncovers adds up to a surprising amount of ancient Greece in today's world. Bishops promoted for their knowledge of ancient Greek, rich donors of monuments mimicking the ancient Greek manner. These are ways in which individuals in more recent times have used the cultural prestige of ancient Greece as a source of social capital, a means of getting on in a world that values the achievements of the ancient Greeks and awards kudos to those who can impress with their knowledge of them. I use the present tense here because old attitudes die hard. In my own life in higher education, I have encountered, as others will have, people who insist that studying ancient Greek writings in the original is intellectually superior to doing so in modern translation. Ancient languages can certainly be hard work, and one should not be surprised to find a hint of social one-upmanship among those who do study them. I have just looked at my copy of the line-by-line English translation of the Greek play I studied for my pre-university Greek exam. Certain pages are full of my penciled markings, underwords, in the margins, and so on. By curious coincidence, these markings start and stop abruptly at the first and last of the chunk of lines which, in the original Greek, were prescribed for that exam. Those who labour over ancient Greek may tout their hard graft, even when they, too, resort to translations. In tracking ancient Greece in modern life, this book does not seek to target a readership with an educational background in the subject. If anything, the reverse is true. For some people, such a background, especially if it involves the study of ancient Greek, can have negative associations of privilege. At least in Britain, the bastions of ancient Greek teaching are often schools and universities that are widely regarded, fairly or not, as the preserve of people who benefit from some unusual access. These are people who carry these negative associations over into cultural pursuits today that feature ancient Greece in one form or another. These might include operas set in ancient Greece or the restaging of ancient Greek plays. This book does not allow the concerns of elite culture to dominate content. It homes in on the presence of ancient Greece where this can be found, whether a word like pandemic, a Freudian state of mind like the Oedipus complex, or a replica Parthenon in a Chinese theme park. Some people may think that to investigate these kinds of impacts is to risk pursuing the banal or mediocre. Arguably, however, a role in shaping the cultural texture of everyday life and popular taste is a worthwhile measure of the enduring influence of ancient Greece. Ancient Greek civilization lasted for centuries. For so long, in fact, that Greek civilizations, in the plural, might seem to do better justice to its different phases of time and place. For simplicity's sake, this book sticks to the catch-all notion of a single civilization. Still, for the purposes of the chapters that follow, there is an issue here of chronology, one that requires us to pause for a moment. Take Homer. To this day, the Greek poet who hymned the Trojan War and its aftermath is an early high point for admirers of Greek civilization. It was probably in the 700s BC that a scribe first wrote down the oral poetry that passes as Homer's. Taking this poetry as the model of excellence, later Greek poets mimicked the master, down to the same number and pattern of beats per line of verse. One of these later poems, in the same metre, tells a story of human passion less catastrophic in its outcome than the Homeric Paris's feelings for Helen of Troy, but, in its humbler way, still moving to read. Two young people fall desperately in love. They live on opposite sides of the narrow strait separating European from Asian Turkey. To pay his surreptitious visits to his strictly guarded beloved, dazzling was her beauty, the youth, by all men called the fair, would dive into the sea at night and swim the mile or so to the European side, guided by the maiden's lamp. This was no mean feat. In 1984, in relatively calm seas, the British travel writer Patrick Lee Fermor did the same with some difficulty. He arrived utterly exhausted, slept for hours, and required a Turkish massage before he revived. Lee Fermor was 68 at the time of this bravura endeavour. By contrast, such exertions left the ardent Leander, the youth, far from spent. On arrival, the maiden's girdle he loosened, and, as the poem in question puts it nicely, the lovers fulfilled the will of Aphrodite, goddess of love. This unbridled passion was their undoing. Once too often the maiden lit her lamp, the signal, and once too often Leander took the plunge. That night saw a raging winter's sea. The wind blew out the lamp. The waves overcame an exhausted Leander. At dawn, Hero, the maiden, spotted his corpse on the rocks below. She hurled herself down. There, on her true love's body, maid Hero's life was done. An affecting tale it is, and a good example of the staying power of the storytelling gift of the ancient Greeks. Experts rightly assign this poem to ancient Greek civilization. Yet its poet was separated from Homer by a distance in time almost as great as that separating the latter poet from us. Musaeus, for that was his name, lived in the AD 400s or 500s, after the last Roman trooper had abandoned Britain, and at a time when invading newcomers had beset his homeland, the Greek-speaking provinces of the old Roman Empire. If only out of concern for the reader's stamina, this book has to take a stand on where to place the chronological limits of ancient Greece. There are difficult decisions here. In the end, I opted to concentrate the search for the ways in which ancient Greece influences the present day on 200 years of ancient Greek civilization, spanning roughly the 400s and the 300s BC, and, wherever possible, to base my conclusions on the ancient writings and ancient artifacts that the Greeks created in those two centuries. This is the age of classical Greece in the strict sense. Extended back a further two generations or so into the early 500s BC, and the whole period covers what some modern admirers of ancient Greece have called the Greek miracle. By that, they mean the era of the flowering of the city-state culture of the ancient Greeks, a time of political and military power, as well as cultural achievement. This modern idea of a miracle embraces the development among some ancient Greeks of an analytical way of thinking that appears to have been new to their society at the time, based as it was on deliberate inquiry, using reason and argument in a way that strikes us as very modern. When this approach first appeared in the early 500s BC, it took its place alongside what the ancient Greeks had always done as they sought to make sense of their world. They would retell traditional tales, stories that demanded what many today would call faith, or even credulity, if they were to be accepted as true. These imaginative stories, the Greeks called them mythoi or myths, offered answers to questions about the origins of human life and the natural world, couched in terms of the doings of divinities. At the same time, they were often entertaining. Nisiros is a small Aegean island, and a lovely one, with a dormant caldera in the middle. The ancient Greeks told a colourful tale about how Poseidon created Nisaros by breaking off a piece of a neighbouring island. The god then threw this chunk of land on top of an enemy, sinking him. Poseidon was the god of the sea and of earthquakes, and the Greeks linked him to the violence of natural phenomena. Of these, the caldera of Nisaros, the work of a huge eruption in prehistoric times, is an awesome example. Today, the naked eye can see without difficulty the kinship between this island's volcanic geology and that of Kos, the near neighbour in question. The ancient myth, in some wise, accounted for these observable facts. Nowadays, people consider the idea of a Greek miracle to be old-fashioned. It shows excessive bias in the way that it judges ancient Greece to have been intellectually superior to such neighboring civilizations as ancient Egypt or Mesopotamia, when no such miracle is deemed to have occurred. That said, a voracious curiosity about humankind and a dialing down of the deference to the supernatural that was otherwise typical of pre-modern societies are traits that do appear to have been marked in pockets of ancient Greek society in the 400s and 300s BC. Not only that, but these traits seem to have encouraged inventive minds and hands to innovate in highly creative ways. Democracy, history writing, medical approaches based on observation and inference, reasoned speculation about God and the universe, art that achieves the illusion of real life, and buildings that strive for mathematical perfection. All these areas of ancient Greek civilization blossomed in the 400s and 300s BC, the political heyday of the Greek city-states. The achievements of these times mainly, though not entirely, account for the afterlife of ancient Greece today, the subject of this book's coming chapters. In Greek mythology, Procrustes was an evil brigand who tortured his victims by lengthening them with weights or shortening them by amputation so as to fit a bed. Today, the bed of Procrustes, where someone or something is obliged to conform, is proverbial, if not quite as widely known as, say, a bed of roses. Not all the relevant achievements of ancient Greece fit into this book's focus on the 200 years between 500 and 300 BC. For instance, there are the Stoics, ancient followers of Greek philosophical precepts traceable back to around 300 BC. Fast forward to the present day, and there are many people who profess to take courses and to follow these ancient precepts. But modern knowledge of ancient Stoicism depends on writings from later times. The founder wrote books, but they have not survived. His early followers in Athens also wrote books, but they, too, are lost. Their teachings were popular enough to continue to attract adherents well into the time of the Roman Empire. To cut the story short, it is to the surviving writings of these much later adherents, Romans and Greek Romans, that we owe the motley quotations, rewordings, and reports of what the first Greek Stoics supposedly thought and wrote two or more centuries earlier. This ancient timeline of the written remnants and echoes of the teachings of Stoicism's ancient founder, one Zeno, falls outside the period from about 500 to 300 BC, on which this book concentrates. But it would be finicky, if not silly, to omit the ancient Stoics. Their modern followers make ancient Stoicism too interesting to leave out. There are other limits to this book. Again, to some extent, to be more honoured in the breach than the observance. Replicas of ancient Greece's most famous monument, the Parthenon, provide a partial map of ancient Greece's continuing hold on the modern imagination. In 1842, a Bavarian king built a full-scale replica of the Parthenon north of Munich from 6,000 blocks of marble imported from Italy. At the end of the same century, the city of Nashville, Tennessee, commissioned another full-size replica of the same temple. Repaired by public demand, it survives today as an art museum and as the backdrop for films such as Percy Jackson and the Olympians, which begins with a meeting between ancient Greek gods atop the Empire State Building. Germany and the United States are countries with strong traditions of admiration for the ancient Greeks. But what about China? As already mentioned, the Chinese recently built a Parthenon replica. It is on the mainland, a few miles from Hong Kong, in a huge amusement park called Window of the World, a 2/3 scale walk-in Parthenon. The company that it keeps, a Colosseum, a Giza Sphinx, and some 130 other replicas of touristic world wonders, hardly proves that Chinese popular culture feels any special curiosity about the ancient Greeks. But in China's powerhouses of the intellect, the case is rather different, as its busy translators from the ancient Greek attest. Each of these replica Parthenons of recent times has a very different local history and context. That said, their distribution across 3 continents might suggest the potential infinitude of a search for ancient Greece in today's world. China's toy Parthenon and its learned translators also hint at how, in a globalized setting, ancient Greece is a universal heritage, irrespective of any modern society's ancestral claims on the ancient Greeks. This complicates the job of deciding what the geographical limits should be of this book's investigations. In deciding, in other words, to whom the us of the title refers. In the end, I chose to focus on the terrain I know best, namely the Anglosphere, Britain and North America especially, but with forays elsewhere so as to present the increasing universalization of ancient Greece across the modern world. To limit the us of the title geographically in this way leaves the problem of how to do justice to the obviously diverse impacts of ancient Greece on what are still great swathes of human society, and how, indeed, to find out what those impacts are in the first place. This book is frankly impressionistic. It offers the author's personal harvesting of the traces of ancient Greece in, mainly, Western culture. This harvesting is based in part on my forays into what are formally called reception studies, that is, the output of academics who specialize in the study of how later times have discovered and responded to, in this case, the ancient Greeks and their works. It is also based on cullings from journalism and other forms of current cultural expression, such as blogs, podcasts, and so on. Here, the internet provides a near infinity of possible leads. At best, I have done no more than gather a personal sample. Because this book offers what is, in the end, a personal view rather than an authoritative survey, I have included what I call autobiographical chit-chat from time to time. This is meant to leaven the loaf, to lighten the book here and there. It is also a way of signalling that the book is a personal reading of what the Greeks did for us. It does not claim to be the only possible reading. Some listeners, I hope not too many, may object to the autobiographical digressions, as they may to the overall impression created by the selection of stories that I have chosen to tell. This process of selection is bound to be subjective, even if I have tried to deal fairly with the diversity of contemporary ways of thinking about the ancient Greeks, which my investigations have uncovered. Today, those who sit up and take notice of the ancient Greeks are not always their uncritical admirers. They include people who believe that the so-called Greek miracle needs taking down a peg or two. This book is not an apology for ancient Greece. Its tone seeks to be dispassionate. It acknowledges and explores the other side of the coin. The ancient Greeks were not exactly socially progressive in the full sense of today's word. Slavery, violence, and what we would call sexism and racism were widespread. Their learned thinkers theorized some of these behaviors. One of the most famous of them in ancient times, and still influential more recently, came from what is now northern Greece. His name was Aristotle. Later chapters will demonstrate how his views on slavery as a natural condition and on the natural inferiority of women have provided ammunition to advocates of these opinions in more recent times. As for violence, like other peoples throughout antiquity, ancient Greek communities relied on force, or the threat of it, to achieve power and to dominate each other, or to protect themselves. The militarism of the ancient Greeks seemed like normal human behavior in its time. Since warring was the prerogative of men, this militarism shaped a certain brand of Greek masculinity and enshrined a certain kind of Greek male heroics. In ancient times, its most feared exponents were the Spartans in their heyday. And whatever the historical realities, in modern times, the ancient Spartans have taken on a life of their own as poster boys for the virtues of militarism, as deplored in a recent article in the American opinion magazine The New Republic. The Spartan legend trades on our deep-seated sense of inadequacy. It mines our insecurities that we aren't enough, hard enough, disciplined enough. If we want our sports team to bring home the trophy, if we want to win a fight, if we want the grit and sheer toughness to triumph at night, we would do well to emulate the Spartans. As Chapter 2 will discuss, not only does this Spartan legend live on today, but it has been adopted as a source of inspiration by activists who promote hardline politics in the USA and elsewhere. So, in a climate in which extreme views are much easier to promote, thanks to modern technology, people today can parade facets of ancient Greece for what some may think are the wrong reasons. Other facets, once in the recesses of the closet, now bask in the cultural sunlight. One way or another, ancient Greek sex continues to exercise modern minds. Visitors to museum collections of Greek objects are confronted with male and female nudes and scenes of sexual desire that can prompt giggles or nudges and winks among people unused to the seemingly casual explicitness of ancient Greek art. After all, this was a world in which householders could put up a pillar of stone carved halfway up with an erect penis to, as a book called Cultural Encyclopedia of the Penis explains, bring good luck and ward off bad luck or the evil eye. The creatives among the ancient Greeks also readily combined images of sex and violence. Greek artists and writers frequently depicted sexual coercion, mainly inflicted by males on females. The most spectacular artwork showing such an episode is out of bounds to the vast majority of people. Visitors to the archaeological museum at Vigina in northern Greece, which is built over the graves of the ancient Macedonian kings, are unable to view a mural that is still in situ, inside a royal tomb too fragile for the public to enter it. Instead, there is a blown-up reproduction, brightly lit and easy to view. The paintwork is sensationally good. It demonstrates Greek artistic mastery by this date, mid-300s BC, of colour, perspective, shading, and the rendering of human emotions. Art historians suggest various possible identities of the unknown artist from among Greece's famous old masters, all of them men. The scene sparingly depicts an older, bearded man with a shifty expression. He is speeding off in his horse-drawn chariot with a half-naked young woman tucked under one arm. She gesticulates frantically back towards a second female, who looks on with a gesture and an expression of horror. The subject is a myth that all ancient Greeks knew. The god of the underworld, Hades, kidnaps a maiden, also a goddess, under the very nose of her mother, herself a divinity, and makes her his wife. I've witnessed a Greek schoolteacher standing before the reproduction and explaining the myth to her charges. Naturally, she did not spell out that the subject of this gorgeous painting is an act of sexual violence committed by a man against a non-consenting unmarried girl, a crime in many jurisdictions today, modern Greece included. For some contemporary viewers, the scene could act as a trauma trigger, showing as it does an ancient episode of forced marriage, and further, sexual assault. What did ancient viewers think? What should we think? As so often with ancient Greek art, the East
sample complete. Ready to continue?